KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Canada's Prime Minister won his election by opposing President Trump's rhetoric about his country. As the two men meet today, we ask a former Canadian foreign minister what success looks like. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration is talking to Rwanda about sending migrants from other countries there. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It was an idea first floated by Britain. What's in it for Rwanda? And how Pope Francis's selection of cardinals from across the global south is influencing discussions at this week's conclave. It is Tuesday, May 6th. On this day in 2001, Pope John Paul II visited a mosque in Damascus, the first pope to enter an Islamic house of worship. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump hosts Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney today at the White House. As Dan Karpinchuk reports from Toronto, Trump and Carney are expected to discuss tariffs and security.
Carney was elected mainly on his campaign of being the best leader to deal with Trump. The two have already had a couple of phone conversations described as positive. Now, as Carney is set to arrive at the White House, some analysts are concerned that he set the right tone, a diplomatic balancing act, where he and Trump can find common ground, while Carney holds firm on Canadian sovereignty. They fear the specter of the dressing down of President Volodymyr Zelensky when he visited the White House. Carney has already said the focus of the talks will be tariffs as well as the future economic and security relationship. It's a high-stakes meeting for Carney, who must stand up for Canada, but walk a fine line in how he does it. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Veterans groups in the U.S. say a Republican-backed budget bill now moving through Congress includes a dangerous loophole. The bill outlines President Trump's domestic policy priorities, but one change would make GI benefits more accessible to for-profit schools. NPR's Quill Lawrence explains.
The Republican policy bill working its way through Congress currently includes a repeal of the 90-10 rule that says for-profit schools can get no more than 90% of their revenue from federal funding. It's a market test to make sure at least 10% of students would pay their own money to go. For years, though, there was a loophole. GI Bill benefits were counted in that 10%. That meant for-profit schools aggressively targeted veterans for enrollment, including so-called diploma mills that drained veterans' benefits without providing a useful degree. Legislation finally closed that loophole in 2023, but veterans' advocacy groups are flagging a line in the current Republican draft bill that would eliminate the 90-10 rule altogether. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The number of Americans working full-time as digital creators skyrocketed in 2024. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports they now make up the largest and fastest-growing share of internet-dependent jobs in the U.S.
A new study by the Interactive Advertising Bureau shows that full-time creator jobs have grown sevenfold in just 4 years. Amani Cheers is with the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. She says what was once seen as a side hustle has grown into a viable career for an increasing number of Americans.
Everything from short videos about food, about fitness, about fashion is really leading people into a space that not only can be incredibly lucrative personally, but has created a whole influencer culture.
The study shows there are nearly 29 million jobs that depend on the internet, but it's the creator economy that's fueling the biggest boom. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down about 140 points. This is NPR. German lawmakers have elected conservative Friedrich Merz as Germany's new chancellor. This was the second vote taken today. He shocked many by losing the first ballot earlier. That loss is seen as embarrassing. Merz's party won Germany's national elections more than 2 months ago. In Sudan, the rebel Rapid Support Forces are still attacking the eastern city of Port Sudan with drones. The city has been a safe haven for about 250,000 Sudanese people. They've fled the militants' civil war with the Sudanese army. Now, the United Nations is warning the militants are attacking vital civilian infrastructure. That includes the airport, the main way food and fuel gets to civilians. The BBC broadcaster David Attenborough turns 99 years old this week. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London. To mark the occasion, Attenborough is releasing a new nature documentary.
Sir David Attenborough, he is a knight, says his latest documentary, released as he enters his 100th year, is the most important of his career. It's called Ocean.
I now understand the most important place on Earth is not on land, but at sea.
In a video clip, Attenborough says oceans are the planet's support system and humanity's greatest ally against climate catastrophe. Scientists and celebrities are attending the film's debut at London's Royal Festival Hall, where a special blue carpet rather than a red one is being rolled out. It opens in cinemas across the UK Thursday, which is Attenborough's 99th birthday. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. It took two rounds for Germany's parliament to elect Friedrich Merz as the country's new chancellor today. The first vote earlier today failed. Despite the wobbly start, the conservative politician has vowed to revive Europe's largest economy, rebuild its military, and boost its presence on the world stage. But U.S. tariffs, concerns about migration, and a surging far-right opposition will make things difficult for him. NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us now to talk about all this. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, Leila.
Okay, so for the first time in Germany's history, Parliament had to vote twice in order to confirm Merz as chancellor. What happened?
Yeah, what happened is that Merz did not have the votes the first time around. And for a good part of today, that was a little scary for his conservative Christian Democratic Party and its Bavarian partner, the CSU, and the center-left Social Democrats. These are all members of the new coalition government. He should have received unanimous votes from all these parties, but it's clear there are some parliamentarians who are not thrilled with what he stands for.
Well, let's talk about what he does stand for. What does Merz stand for?
Well, yesterday, when Merz signed the coalition agreement, he summed it up pretty succinctly.
Dieses Land sucht nach einer Regierung.
And Leila, he's saying here that Germany is looking for a government that from its first day gets down to work powerfully and systematically, and that is precisely his plan.
And how likely is it that he'll have the support in Germany's parliament to do that?
Yeah, as we've seen today, this is not going to be easy for him. That's because the parties in his new government hold a very narrow majority in parliament, just a dozen more than the minimum required. And the party that'll be snapping at their heels is the Alternative for Germany party, known in Germany as the AfD. It is a far-right anti-immigration party that has close ties to Russia. One out of every five voters in Germany voted for it. This party now has its largest representation in parliament ever, and it will do a lot to try and disrupt Merz's agenda.
So how will Merz be able to fight that opposition?
Well, he's already started to do that. You know, earlier this year, Merz steered a law through the previous parliament to exempt the military from Germany's strict debt rules. Now, that enabled Germany to significantly increase the defense budget. This was a very bold and, for Germany, incredibly swift move that showed Merz's leadership weeks before he was even chancellor. Another way he's going to fend off the AfD is by looking tough on immigration. Mm. And there are signs he's going to do that. He wants to push through tougher border policies to curb migration and into Germany. So that could also take the wind out of the AfD's sails.
Last week, a German government agency declared the AfD an extremist party, paving the way for domestic intelligence to monitor that party, as you know. So how is that going down in Germany?
Yeah, it's a big development. It clears the way for Germany's Office for the Protection of the Constitution to do things like tap phones of the AfD to hire informants. And just to explain here, these powers were enshrined in Germany's constitution after World War II to prevent another party like the Nazis from gaining power. So now that the largest opposition party in parliament can be monitored like this, It really makes for a dramatic political theater. Now that Merz is chancellor, he's going to be in this weird, precarious position of pushing to limit or even ban the AfD due to its threat to Germany's democracy. We don't know yet how he's going to use that power, but we do know that he desperately wants to carry out his agenda to restore Germany's economy, military, and status in Europe, and that he'll likely not have much patience for anyone who stands in his way.
That's NPR's Berlin correspondent, Rob Schmitz. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
President Trump is hosting Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney at the White House today. Earlier this morning, Michelle spoke with John Manley about the visit. He's had multiple top leadership roles in Canada in both the public and private sectors. He's a former deputy prime minister, foreign minister, and finance minister. He's been the CEO of a business leaders group, and he has worked closely with U.S. leaders across Republican and Democratic administrations.
So when President Trump was asked yesterday about his expectations for his meeting with Prime Minister Carney, he said this.
I don't know. He's coming to see me. I'm not sure what he wants to see me about, but I guess he wants to make a deal. Everybody does.
So let's turn this around. What do you think Prime Minister Carney is hoping to accomplish today?
Well, first, my understanding is that President Trump, in his phone call last week, invited Prime Minister of Canada to come and visit him. And I think for Mr. Carney, it was that important first meeting that he's got to get out of the way. It's high risk for him on both sides, and he felt that if invited, he should come.
So from your perspective, what would a successful outcome look like today? Are we likely to see some policy movement, or is this more about optics? I mean, I think it's, you know, we've seen that President Trump sometimes like to dominate people in the Oval Office, certain comments, and, you know, just the way his sort of body language works. So what do you think a successful meeting would look like today?
For Mr. Carney, it's going to be important that he resist any of the comments about Canada becoming annexed to the United States or a 51st state that he say, as Canadians believe. Those kinds of comments are highly insulting to us and are of little interest to us. Canada has great national pride, its own history, its own institutions. It's very happy as a collaborator, a cooperator, an ally and trading partner of the United States, but our independence is fundamentally important to us. That's why Mark Carney got elected, and I think he's going to have to make those points to President Trump directly if there's anything that suggests otherwise.
So you don't see that any policy movement per se, you mean more, you think it's more a matter of Prime Minister Carney establishing himself as an equal, as it were. Would that be right?
I think that's right. I think that he would see it as very successful if the president committed to an early negotiation of the USMCA. But I think that it's very difficult for Canada to enter into such a negotiation while the United States is in violation of the agreement that President Trump signed in 2020. So achieving some certainty or stability around how the economic relationship is to be structured going forward would be desirable. Uncertainty is the enemy of decision-making in business, and we're dealing for the last 100 and some days with great and continuing uncertainty on that score.
Mr. Carney himself, what do you think his chief assets are in dealing with Mr. Trump?
Mark Carney is a very serious dude. He was central bank governor in Canada during the global financial crisis, where the British were so impressed with him that they brought him to the UK. He was governor of the Bank of England and was in that role during the Brexit crisis. He's dealt with some big, complicated issues. and he's got a deep background in business, both as a managing director of Goldman Sachs, but later as a senior executive in Brookfield. So he's got business, government, and central banking experience. I don't think, with great respect to Justin Trudeau, that Donald Trump ever took him that seriously.
You think that his business background would perhaps create common ground that President Trump might value more?
I think those additional credentials make him somebody that that Donald Trump is more likely to see as worthy of his respect. We always worry, as Canadians dealing with Donald Trump, that we somehow trigger his bully reflex. I think that Justin Trudeau had a tendency to do that, and it wasn't to Canada's benefit.
Before we let you go, you've had a lot of experience in managing cross-border relationships yourself. What's different about navigating that relationship now? We have about 40 seconds left.
My biggest intergovernmental role was post 9/11, when I was in charge of Canada's response. We wanted to solve a common problem. In this case, we don't understand what problem Donald Trump is trying to solve for.
That is former Canadian Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister John Manley. Mr. Manley, thank you so much for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Michelle.
More than a dozen former employees of the secretive tech firm Palantir are speaking out. They helped build data mining and surveillance tools that are now being used in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the workers warn against heading down a dangerous path in the history of technology.
When software engineer Linda Shaw started working at Palantir, she says the company believed its software should respect privacy and civil rights.
When I first joined Palantir, one of the things I was really impressed by was that people talked about the ethics and people could disagree. And there was a lot of controversy around the work with ICE.
She says the company's surveillance and data analyzing contracts with the Trump administration show it has left those values behind. Shaw and a dozen other former tech workers wrote a letter exclusively shared with NPR saying Palantir's founding principles are being violated by allowing its tools to do things like collect biometric data on migrant children. Last month, Immigration and Customs Enforcement finalized a $30 million contract with Palantir to have near real-time visibility into migrant movements.
If we care about our democracy and freedoms of speech and due diligence and the rule of law, that this isn't controversial, that this is a thing that should not be happening.
Palantir and the White House did not respond to NPR's request for comment. For 13 former employees to speak out is significant. Much of the company's intelligence and military work is secret, and many workers sign non-disparagement agreements when they leave. Others hold stock in the company, which is worth nearly $300 billion. Palantir's AI tools are getting even more popular in the Trump era. Here's CEO Alex Karp speaking to investors on Monday.
We're seeing very significant demand for our software, our government software. Those are early days, but the signal there is very strong.
Since co-founding the company with billionaire Peter Thiel more than 20 years ago, Karp has said that Palantir's data mining services are intended to make Western democracy stronger. But former employee Shaw asks, what happens when the technology is used by a government that has little apparent regard for democratic rights?
In the broadest sweeping terms, Western values means democracy and freedom of speech. And these are things that are definitively not being supported by this administration.
During Trump's first term, tech workers loudly resisted their industry's work with parts of the government. Now, Silicon Valley tech executives are largely supporting the president, and the rank and file are more muted. But the former Palantir employees say they hope to trigger a domino effect against Trump's policies. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
on the next Fresh Air, Emmy winner and Oscar nominee Michelle Williams. In the new limited TV series, Dying for Sex, she plays a woman who finds out she's dying of cancer and decides to leave her unhappy marriage and her life behind to seek pleasure and sexual satisfaction. Williams will tell us about portraying characters experiencing grief, loss, and resilience. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Some of you may have enjoyed a tequila or two or ten in honor of Cinco de Mayo. It might have even been a José Cuervo pour.
He was a real person born in the Tequila Valley in the late 19th century and someone who built the industry.
That's Ted Genoways, author of Tequila Wars, José Cuervo and the Bloody Struggle for the Spirit of Mexico. We spoke about his new book chronicling Mexico's oldest alcohol brand. So let's start then with the origins of tequila that date back to the indigenous people of Mexico. How did the colonization by the Spanish change what we came to know as tequila?
Yeah, so the indigenous people were fermenting agave and creating drinks from that, and also may have been doing some form of single distillation. The Spaniards, when they arrived, brought in double distillation and then brought in more advanced distillation technology, and over time that evolved into something that was not from other kinds of mezcal.
Let's talk about José Cuervo, the real person behind all of this, the one you call the godfather of tequila. Why did you want to write a book about this particular person?
Well, because first of all, he's someone who, as you said, we didn't even know for the most part he was a real person. His whole life story has essentially been forgotten. And the more I dug into the archives and newspaper records and got access to some family materials, the more I discovered that he was really a central figure, not just in the evolution of the industry that he led, But because he wanted tequila to be something that was an international product, he was really influential in Mexican politics and in the driving of technology that allowed for distribution and increased production and publicity around his product. And what I came to see was somebody who had really transformed his country and had certainly revolutionized his industry. But because he was a sort of shy and retiring person whose interest was in promoting his brand, but keeping himself out of the limelight, he had been almost completely forgotten.
You know, in reading your book, I couldn't help but just think that the history of tequila and the history of the nation of Mexico are too intertwined, right? It's almost like they can't exist without the other.
It's really true. I guess I had always thought of tequila as a kind of cultural symbol and something that defined Mexico in that way, as a kind of national spirit. But what I came to discover was that they really were the builders of the country and were deeply, deeply involved in the way that the country evolved and the politics that made that play out.
And tequila over the years has kept an eye on the American market. And that got me thinking about all the different celebrity tequila brands. Actors, athletes, influencers have tequila brands. But then I think about its bloody history and how it's intertwined with a nation that has struggled in a lot of different ways over the decades and actually over the centuries. Is the spirit of Mexico still in tequila, or is it now just belong to the world?
I think it's still a very Mexican product, and there's no question that American celebrities in particular have had a great influence on the industry in recent years. They have shaped its image in the popular imagination in the United States. But when you visit Tequila, the town of Tequila, and you stand on the plaza, one of the things that I can never get enough of is that the bandstand that Jose Cuervo built in 1909 is still the center of the plaza. The distillery where Jose Cuervo made his tequila is there. The cobblestone streets that Cuervo had laid that are made from the obsidian that came from the volcano that is on the horizon is there. This is a product that can only be made by international agreement in certain regions in Mexico. But ground zero will always, always be the town of Tequila. And to me, that product belongs perhaps to the world, but it is also rooted in that very specific place. And the people who have lived there for generations and are still making tequila there are the true spirit of that industry.
Ted Genovese is the author of Tequila Wars, Jose Cuervo, and the Bloody Struggle for the Spirit of Mexico. Ted, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The desire to have kids can be overwhelming for some parents, but maybe more people are on the fence than we realize.
Maternal ambivalence is the norm, and yet we're told that people that are hell yes are the norm.
Writer Ruthie Ackerman explains the less talked about paths to parenthood and her new book on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is the latest world leader to meet with President Trump at the White House. As NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports, Carney is tempering expectations from today's talks given Canada's rebuke of Trump's tariffs and sovereignty threats.
The thing to keep in mind about Carney is that he won this election running with an anti-Trump message. Canadians were voting as Trump was ramping up his tariff war, and Canada's economy is highly dependent on exports to the U.S. And Trump doesn't like that Canada sells more than it buys. Trump continues to say he wants to make Canada into America's 51st state. So the election there was seen as a referendum against Trump.
The Ford Motor Company is pulling its financial projections for the year, citing the uncertainty over President Trump's trade policies. More from NPR's Giles Snyder.
Ford says it's suspending its initial earnings forecast in the $7 billion to $8.5 billion range before interest and taxes, saying updating its full-year guidance is too much of a challenge right now. Ford says it has moved to offset the tariff impact, but that the levies will likely cost the automaker $1.5 billion in operating profits this year.
The next German chancellor is Friedrich Merz. The conservative leader prevailed in the second round of voting in parliament hours after an unprecedented defeat in the first round of voting. From Washington, this is NPR News. Sudan's wartime capital city, Port Sudan, has been attacked by a series of drone strikes launched by the paramilitary group at war with Sudan's army. The city was previously a safe haven during the country's two-year civil war. However, attacks for the last 3 days have struck several areas and caused a power outage. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports the number of casualties is not yet clear.
The drone strikes hit a terminal at the city's only airport overnight on Tuesday local time, leaving all flights grounded. The popular Marina Hotel was also struck, close to the residence of Sudan's leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The drone strikes by the Rapid Support Forces follow similar strikes over the previous 2 days, targeting an ammunition facility, an oil depot, and civilian areas. Port Sudan was a sleepy city before the war, but became a sanctuary for thousands of refugees and the temporary capital after the war ignited on the streets of Khartoum. Now it's under attack. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
The maker of ChatGPT has decided to stay nonprofit. The CEO of OpenAI, Sam Altman, says the artificial intelligence company decided to drop its plans to convert itself into a for-profit business following talks with attorneys general of California and Delaware and hearing from civic leaders. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is down 162 points. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead, online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. When cardinals enter the Sistine Chapel Wednesday to choose a new pope, the conclave will be unique. For the first time, fewer than half of the voting cardinals are European. Pope Francis appointed cardinals from Myanmar, Rwanda, Tonga, and many other countries in the global south. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports on how this will influence who ends up being the next pope.
In churches all over Rome this week, cardinals who've flown in for the conclave hold masses. They've travelled from some 70 countries. In the 1900s, power was concentrated close to Rome. Almost all the cardinals were European. This conclave, the late Pope Francis made sure, will be truly global. Francis appointed the vast majority, 80% of the 135 cardinals originally eligible to vote in this conclave.
We went through a time where it was very much the church focused on the church, and I think Francis has been a pope for the world.
Alistair Dutton is the Secretary General of Caritas Internationalis.
He really wanted a world, an economy, a social vision that was focused on people and the poorest.
Some of the newer cardinals have direct experience with the hardship of war and extraordinary personal stories, like that of Cardinal Diodone Zapalenga from the Central African Republic.
Rebelle venait pour chasser.
At the height of the conflict between Christian and Muslim factions in his country, Zapalenga risked his life to save the nation's leading Muslim figure.
Et on voyait la haine des rebelles.
The rebels came to fight against the Muslims. I went to look for the imam and I asked him to come and live with me, he says. I saw the hatred in the rebels' eyes. The Christian cardinal and Muslim imam lived side by side in the cardinal's home and worked to try to end the war.
Il a passé six mois chez moi.
The first non-European pope in centuries, this change in the makeup of cardinals to include more countries from the global south was Pope Francis's quiet revolution. But there is a strong backlash from factions that want to return to a more traditional and perhaps for some more Western-centric church.
A lot of meals in discreet places where that conversation is going to go on.
Father Robert Sirico, who helps run a religious think tank, says having cardinals from many countries who don't know each other, or Rome, could make it easier for the older guard to influence the newcomers.
If I were a cardinal, I would be lining up the names of people that I want to know and inviting them to dinner or coffee or whatever it happens to be, and have a few points of reference.
The cardinals have been meeting at the Vatican to discuss exactly this. What are the priorities for the church that will shape their choice of pope?
I'm here by one of the exits of the Vatican, and this is where the cardinals come out after meeting in the general congregation. And it is a press scrum. It is dozens of journalists waiting to try to catch one of these cardinals in their black and red robes to get any kind of comment, any kind of clue, any kind of information. They are the people of the moment.
I chase Jorge Enrique Jimenez Carvajal from Colombia and ask him, is the diversity of cardinals doing what Francis hoped? Has it changed what they're prioritizing in these meetings?
Eso es clarísimo. Es que
this is very clear, Cardinal Carvajal says. The church has opened a new dialogue with the world. Is it time for another pope from the global south? It's very difficult to say. The only person who knows that, says Carvajal, is God. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Rwanda says it is in, quote, early talks with the Trump administration to take in migrants from other countries who are deported from the United States. Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg explains.
We are now in talks with the U.S. about a deal on migration.
That's Rwanda's foreign minister, Olivia Indahungirehe, confirming on Rwandan state TV what was already rumored, that Kigali is in discussions with Washington about accepting deported third country migrants. If you think this rings a bell, that's because, as the minister pointed out, it does.
It's not the first time that we'll be engaging in such a kind of deal, but this is a bilateral issue.
Britain's previous Conservative government spent almost $1 billion on a deal to send asylum seekers to Rwanda.
The eyes to the right, 320. The nose to the left, 276.
That plan was found unlawful by the UK Supreme Court and ultimately discarded before it ever got off the ground after a Labour government came to power last year. But now it seems the US is considering taking a page out of the Conservative Party playbook in its talks with Rwanda. President Trump has made cracking down on illegal immigration a key priority, and many deportations are being challenged in court.
We are working with other countries to say, we want to send you some of the most despicable human beings to your countries. Will you do that as a favor to us?
Secretary of State Marco Rubio talking last month about other third country options for deportations.
And the further away from America, the better, so they can't come back across the border. I'm not apologizing.
The United States already has this kind of agreement with El Salvador, Mexico, and Panama, who have all agreed to take deportees who are not their nationals. On Monday, asked to confirm that the U.S. and Rwanda are in talks about deportees, a U.S. State Department spokesperson told NPR that, quote, ongoing engagement with foreign governments is vital to deterring illegal and mass migration and securing our borders. Michaela Wrong, journalist and author of a book on Rwanda, said the East African country has a terrible human rights record and is not a suitable place to send deportees.
One of the main reasons for objecting to this deal, though, has to do with what's happening in neighboring Congo.
The UN says Rwanda is backing rebels who recently overran key towns in the Democratic Republic of Congo's mineral-rich east. Washington has been trying to mediate, promising U.S. investments in the critical minerals sector there if Rwanda and DRC make peace. Wrong said if Kigali agrees to take its deportees, the U.S. might take the pressure off Rwanda regarding its actions in Congo.
The timing of this deal does not seem to me to be a coincidence, and I think it would be extremely damaging if a deal of this kind were to go through.
And extremely costly, not just for the U.S. Rwanda is a developing country that already has a significant refugee population from years of regional wars. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
This is NPR News.
A Washington Post investigation looked into the chaotic 48 hours surrounding the Trump administration's efforts to fly migrants to a Salvadoran prison. More next time on Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. A rare king vulture has hatched at the Bronx Zoo. Some king vultures neglect their babies, so to make sure the chick survives, the zoo is hand-feeding the chick. But to keep the chick from becoming attached to humans, a staffer hides their features and feeds the baby with a custom hand puppet that looks like a vulture. It's a technique the zoo says it developed 4 decades ago to raise 3 Andean condors that were later released into the wild. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. President Trump says he wants to reopen Alcatraz. The former prison is a mile and a half off the coast of San Francisco. The Federal Bureau of Prisons closed Alcatraz in 1963, saying it was nearly three times more expensive to operate than any other federal prison. It has no sewer system or fresh water, and all the water, fuel, and supplies have to be delivered by boat. Now, the island is one of the most popular national park sites in the country. Joining me now is Scott Wiener, a California State Senator whose district is in San Francisco. So, Senator Wiener, what was your reaction to hearing the news that President Trump wanted to somehow reopen Alcatraz Prison?
This is truly a ridiculous proposal to make Alcatraz a prison. Again, it's like setting taxpayer money on fire. 1.4 million people a year visit Alcatraz. It's one of the most popular properties in the whole National Park Service. It's right up there with the Golden Gate Bridge in terms of attractions in San Francisco.
On Monday, the U.S. Bureau of Prisons says that they're going to pursue all avenues to try and see if they can make this happen for President Trump. Wondering what would have to happen on the local end for this to even be something that could be considered?
Yeah, it would be unbelievably expensive. I mean, they would have to remove the museum that's been there for more than half a century. And they'd have to build a new prison from scratch. The building that's there now is ancient. The salt water was actually starting to destroy the foundation of the building. It was going to have to need a huge public investment. And so they made the smart decision to say, let's not have a prison here anymore.
The president's goal is to put dangerous individuals away securely. Are there any other sites in California that if this is something that became a real thing, that could accommodate these people that President Trump wants to put away?
Well, the question is, who is it that he wants to put away? He claims that a lot of people are dangerous who are not dangerous. He says he wants to deport 10 million immigrants, claiming that they're all criminals, which is false. And that's why it's concerning to me that he wants to create this new institution where Lord knows who he's going to put there, whether it's going to be his political opponents or just sweeping people up off the streets and not giving them due process and then refusing to follow court orders.
If it were at some point to become a federal prison again, what do you think that means to your constituents, to the city of San Francisco, to know that this is there right there on the water for everyone to kind of look at?
My constituents are not going to be happy if Alcatraz is lost as a tourist destination, as a museum, as a place to go and learn about history. There's a whole economic ecosystem that exists around Alcatraz, the tour guides, the boats, all of the people whose livelihood depends on this popular federal attraction. And that'll all be taken away. So this is not a popular idea in San Francisco.
That is California State Senator Scott Wiener. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And NPR reached out to the National Park Service for comment. In a statement, J. Elizabeth Peace said the Department of the Interior and the National Park Service has nothing to add at this time. The president's statement speaks for itself. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Since returning to office, President Trump has tried to dramatically shrink the federal government, firing workers and moving to sell off federal real estate. Republicans have also been debating whether to make it easier to sell off some public land to help pay for Trump's domestic agenda. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports this is reigniting a decades-old controversy in the West.
In most Western states, the federal government owns half or more of all the land, and it seems like every day here now there's a headline warning that public lands are in danger of being transferred to state control or even privatized. An editorial in Idaho's largest newspaper predicts they're about to be sold to the highest bidder. On Instagram, the National Wildlife Federation says public lands are on the chopping block, the inference being that President Trump's mass firings of U.S. Forest Service and other employees are a step toward eliminating the federal lands agencies altogether.
Congress is considering selling off our public lands to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy.
Tracy Stone Manning headed the Federal Bureau of Land Management during the Biden administration. The agency controls a tenth of all U.S. land. She's now president of the Wilderness Society.
What we're seeing from this administration is no balance at all.
Groups like the Wilderness Society seized on a recently leaked Department of Interior plan that calls for giving more land management authority to local governments in places where there's a lot of federal land. This plan also calls for the release of, quote, federal holdings to build housing. Environmentalists say this is a blueprint for turning over tens of millions of acres of prized hunting and recreation land. But Casey Hammond, who was the acting director of the BLM during the first Trump administration, calls this fear-mongering.
Frankly, this is how many NGOs attempt to stay relevant. It helps them sell more calendars and teddy bears and fundraise.
Hammond says Republicans are simply trying to correct course from what he says was a disastrous conservation-only strategy for public lands during the Biden era.
I don't see an aggressive push for any wholesale transfer. I don't see it in any of these draft documents that have come out. I don't hear it in conversation among appointees. I don't hear it on the Hill.
Still, Republican leaders in Utah, with the backing of Senator Mike Lee, are vowing to keep suing to wrest control of 18 million acres of federal lands. And the idea of an overbearing federal government has long been red meat for Republican fundraisers. It was President Reagan who first coined sagebrush rebels, calling for federal rangelands to be turned over to cattle ranchers and miners. A Reagan appointee wrote the section on federal lands in Project 2025. It calls for speeding up permitting for energy projects and reversing Biden-era climate policies, but there's no mention of transferring ownership of the land. Again, Casey Hammond.
I think what we found during the last Trump administration is there's no need for such discussion if we're doing our job. And that is to say, if we're effectively managing federal lands, there's no reason to turn them over to the states to be managed better.
This may be a nod to today's political realities in the West, too, though. A controversial proposal that would have made it easier to sell off federal lands was taken out of the House Republican budget late last week. But at the University of Utah, law professor John Ruppel says Congress still has the authority at any time to work with Trump and pass a law selling off federal land to anyone, states, tribes, oil companies.
That's kind of the could piece. I think the bigger question is, should the government do this? Should the U.S. convey away lands that belong to all Americans?
Two Trump-supporting congressmen from Idaho and Montana say no. They recently introduced a bill to prevent any wholesale transfer or sale of federal land. Kirk Siegler, NPR News, Denver.
Earlier this year, Doug Rook was told his prostate cancer had spread. He was given about a year to live. His dying wish, to help people by volunteering in all 50 states.
He started a volunteer tour he calls Dying to Serve. So far, he's made 18 stops in 16 states. Rook spoke to us about his diagnosis and how he's resolved to spend his remaining time.
I really was given two options, you know, seek heavy treatment, heavy chemo, radiation, surgery possibly, and maybe only gained 6 months out of my life because this small cell prostate cancer is very aggressive. In my mind, the choices I was given was 18 to 24 months of misery or 8 to 12 months plus of going out and living my life. I've spent the last, 30 plus years chasing the dollar, and what suffered is my humanity. I didn't spend enough time with friends and loved ones that I should have. I was working 60 hours a week. I just realized I hadn't helped enough people. So once I realized that, then it was just a matter of what I was gonna do. And at first it was just maybe go help the hurricane victims in North Carolina. Then it was see if I can also go help the fire victims in California. And then once I really started thinking about it, I'm like, well, why should I limit this to two states? There's so much I haven't done and seen in this country that maybe I can try and do them all. I know it's very ambitious, but that's when I came up with the Dying to Serve tour. I volunteered at several food pantries where I was helping stock or, helping the clients check out. Food banks where I would help pull orders for the other organizations that get their food from the banks. It's not about the cancer anymore. It's about a legacy of volunteering and specifically micro-volunteering. What I'm learning is these wonderful organizations I'm volunteering for, they would have their needs completely filled if more people would just volunteer 3 or 4 hours a month. A month, that's it. I want to get the word out and inspire and encourage people to volunteer for a few hours a month. And if enough people do it, it will make a drastic difference. This country is so divided right now. I just think that if more people gave of themselves, we'd find more common ground.
That's Doug Rook. He calls his volunteer tour Dying to Serve. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm E. Martinez.